This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Would you say it's time for our viewers to crack each other's heads open and feast on the goo inside?
Yes, I would, Ken.
Jonah Goldberg, Rob Long, we are getting together on Sunday, April 26th at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific, for a live Zoom glop culture.
That's amazing. The only way to watch this thing, I mean, assuming that you're the kind of person that needs to watch it, is that you've got to be a member of Ricochet, you got to be a subscriber to Commentary, or a subscriber to The Dispatch. Jonah, tell them about The Dispatch.
The Dispatch is this new media company that Steve Hayes and I
Great.
Started.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, okay. But that's right. You have to be a member of good standing of the what the Germans call Der Drei Podcastersbund, one of these three fine institutions.
Sunday, April 26th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific. Members of Ricochet, subscribers to The Dispatch or Commentary Magazine.
Yeah.
Live glop culture.
You know, I don't know how long this fun kind of inside time is going to last. It's not going to last forever, so you got to take advantage of it now.
It sure feels like this promo is going to last forever.
No. We'll do it live!
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. Go to thedispatch.com to find the secret of the universe and everything. And today's episode is brought to you by ExpressVPN. More about them later. I'm very excited about today's podcast. This is probably peak trend for us in terms of getting people we've long wanted on this podcast but weren't able to until they were put under house arrest. One of my I've had lots of authors on here, and very rarely have I said anything like this. Truly one of my absolute favorite authors, a guy who helped introduce me to all sorts of new ways of thinking about a number of things. Matt Ridley is here today. Matt is the author of 7 books, including the upcoming How Innovation Works, which I've just started. He was a Washington correspondent for The Economist. He was a science editor there. He's the American editor. He founded the Mind and Matter column in the Wall Street Journal. He was a weekly columnist for The Telegraph and The Times. He is, which I think is one of the most awesome things we've had. We've had senators on here, but this is our first member of the House of Lords, which is truly wild. And I understand that when he was a younger man, he baked 12-minute brownies in 7 minutes. So, Matt Ridley, welcome to The Remnant.
Jonah, thank you so much for having me on this show. The admiration is mutual. I've adored your writings over the years, and it's just fantastic to meet you.
We'll get you the best doctors, but thank you. So, there are lots of places that we can start with, but since you're an author and you're writing about stuff that I'm deeply interested in, since I worked on my last book and since I've been sort of somewhat inculcated into the cult of Deirdre McCloskey, your new book, How Innovation Works, starts really intriguingly. So even though it is not out yet, but as we say on this podcast all the time, this podcast moves books. Now is the time to pre-order. Why don't you sort of lay out what you're writing about in the book and why you decided to write about it?
Yeah. Well, in the end, all roads lead to innovation if you're trying to explain the modern world. If you're trying to explain the bad things as well as the good, you need to come back to what's changed. And we have this extraordinary phenomenon called innovation that happens to us and not to rabbits or rocks and didn't happen to our ancestors until really quite recently in terms of regular innovation where it happens all the time. And it's a mysterious phenomenon. There's a thousand books about it. There's a million books about it. But I would argue that nobody's quite cracked the problem of why it happens, when and where it does, in which countries, in which industries, and who's involved in making the discoveries and applications that change the world. So I've danced around this topic on a number of previous books, but I thought I would actually dive into innovation itself and just tell stories. Just start by telling six or seven stories from six or seven different sectors of the world, from transport and energy and public health and whatever else, and then draw the lessons from those about what it is that we need to do to make sure that innovation happens and is a beneficial process.
Right. So why don't we just sort of start with, you know, I don't want to say you were begging the question, but what actually is innovation? I mean, just sort of in the nuts and bolts of it.
Well,
it's making new things out of old things. It's
making new things out of old things, but it's doing so in a way that sticks, in a way that is affordable, replicatable, sort of sustainable. So in other words, it's not invention. I make a very important distinction between invention, coming up with a new idea or a new prototype of a gadget, and on the other hand, coming up with something that everybody buys, everybody needs, or not everybody, but lots of people. People like Thomas Edison, he wasn't really the original inventor of the light bulb, or indeed many of the other things that he's famous for, but he was the innovator. He was the guy who put a team of people onto working out how to make a light bulb really reliable so that it lasted for thousands of hours before the filament burnt out, so that it could be manufactured, so that it could not blow up the whole time, et cetera, et cetera. So that's and of course, he famously said, I think he used the word invention, but let's just put innovation in there instead. Innovation is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. So what I'm focused on in this book is very much the people who take ideas and turn them into practical products that change the world. I think we pay too much attention to the heroic guy who has the brainwave at the start of the process. And often it isn't the start. Often once you go back and look, you find that he's feeding off predecessors who are feeding off predecessors and so on. So it's a very gradual process by which the light goes on over someone's head. But nonetheless, what really matters is the hard work, the trial and error that goes into turning a new idea into something that actually changes the world, into, you know, an airplane that can fly or a car that can work. You know, the Wright brothers are beautiful examples of innovators. It wasn't that much that they invented that was brand new, but they put it together and they tested it and tried and tried and tried inch by inch incrementally till they had something that could fly.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why I like this is, first of all, it confirms a lot of my priors, which I always enjoy, but is one of the things we talk about a lot on here is the famous essay, at least in the States, iPencil, which I'm sure you've run into at some point. And, you know, I make this point all the time about how no one knows how to make a pencil. No one knows how to make an iPhone. The people who get the credit for making these things, either in the way I usually tell it, know how to put together the last 1% of the process. And what I like about this is that this is sort of like an analog to that, in that the same thing goes with the spark of the creative idea at the beginning of the mm-hmm. process, right? It's right. No one knows how to innovate a light bulb. They know how to take these different ideas and advance the thinking one click further along, and then they get a lot of credit for it, which is an interesting way to think about things.
Yeah, I mean, if you take Moore's Law, which is a plot of the gradual improvement of computing power over time, it's fantastically gradual. It's very incremental. There are no jumps or leaps in it. And if you extrapolate it back to previous technologies, to electromechanical relays and things like that, and in terms of plotting the cost per quantity of computing that you're able to achieve, again, there's no step changes. It's really weird. It's far more gradual than we think. We think in terms of these breakthrough revolutions where we disrupt the world and everything changes overnight, and it just doesn't look like that the more you look at it. You know, the first motor cars looked like a horse carriage met a steam engine around the back of a bicycle shed and had illicit relations. 20 years later, cars look completely different, but it has to get there gradually. It doesn't get there in one jump.
So there's an interesting other analog to this, which is I've had this theory for a very long time that books that are often given credit for launching a new mode of thinking or a new political movement tend to be lagging indicators rather than leading indicators. And if you look at Charles Reich wrote this book, The Greening of America, which supposedly gave birth to the youth movement in America in the 1960s. And it came very late in the process. Herbert Croly's Promise of American Life, which supposedly gave birth to the progressive movement in America. These were, whatever the merits of the books, and The Greening of America is a terrible book. But the interesting thing to me is that what was really going on was that there was this nascent, inchoate movement on the ground that needed a totem to galvanize their thinking around. And so these books sometimes, I think you could probably make the case about a lot of Marx, that this stuff was in the water and it needed some sort of totem or focal point to say, aha, this is what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I would bet if you went through and looked at the great philosophers and the great sort of social commentators of the last 2000 years, a very similar process to what you're talking about is going on, is that these people took these things that were out in the air and advanced them just slightly enough to make them seem like a huge innovation. And they were recognized as such because people already agreed on them to a large extent.
Yeah, and that you're absolutely right. And that is illustrated very nicely by the phenomenon of simultaneous invention, which people like Kevin Kelly have written about very interestingly in his book, What Technology Wants. 21 different people came up with the idea of the light bulb, the incandescent light bulb, independently around the same time as Edison. I mean, as far as one can make out, there's no communication. There's a guy called Lodygin in Russia. There's a guy called Swan in Britain. There's Hiram Maxim. There's somebody in France, somebody in Belgium, etc. Now, what's that telling you? It's telling you that the technology is ripe. It's ready to fall from the tree. Something about the combination of glass blowing, vacuum pumps, electricity systems, and the use of arc lighting has come together in a way that Thomas Edison is run over by a tram. It doesn't make any difference. We still get light bulbs in the 1870s. Or if you bring it more up to date and you tell the same story about search engines in the 1990s, there are hundreds of search engines in the early 1990s. Google is just one of them. If Larry Page never meets Sergey Brin, it's not a different world with no search engines. It's a world in which the search engine is not called Google, but that's that's a different point. And then the beauty of this way of looking at the world, I think, is that if you go back 5 or 10 years before that point and say, well, wasn't it obvious then looking forward that search engines were going to be the way to make money out of the internet? Nobody saw that coming. In fact, Larry Page and Sergey Brin didn't see that coming. They didn't even think they were inventing a search engine. They thought they were cataloging the internet. So there's something tremendously asymmetrical about innovation. It looks fantastically obvious and inevitable when you look backwards, but it looks completely unpredictable when you look forwards. And I find that rather fascinating. I grapple with that. I don't fully solve that issue in my book, but I tell enough stories about it for readers to make up their own minds.
Yeah, so I have two separate questions. I'm trying to figure out how I could not make them forks in the road. I guess you know, one of the things I've always been that I harp on a lot is this point that I first got from Deirdre McCloskey, though I think it's in Rational Optimist as well.
Well, I probably got it from Deirdre too. So,
yeah, no, there's a lot of cross pollination in all of this, but this point that innovation, up until really recently in human history, was essentially taboo, you know, or a sin, depending on how you define these things and what culture you're in. But there was something about the, whether you call it the coalition instinct or the powers that be or the or guild economics, that saw any questioning of the status quo as a threat. And so you have the, you know, the Chinese calling home the ships and getting rid of steel production and not doing anything with the printing press. You have in Western Europe, the sin of Curitas, questioning the established order and all of that. And then it busts through in the late, you know, the 1600s and 1700s. What is your personal explanation for why it took that long for society to recognize innovation as a positive thing rather than a negative thing?
I want to come back to that question in just 2 seconds because I've got a tangent I want to slip away on.
Briefly,
you're saying you can't remember where you got a certain idea from. Reminds me of a very nice story that happened to me. There's a very good book called Second Nature by a professor called Haim Ofek, who I never met. But I read the book and thought it was great. And it had one idea in it that I thought was startlingly good. It was basically that the whole of human history, we've been moving towards diversifying our consumption, but narrowing our production. That's kind of the big theme of human history, as it were. You get more and more specialized in what you produce so that you can be more and more diversified in what you consume. And I wrote to him and said, this is a superb idea. You know, where did you get it from, et cetera? And he wrote back and he said, I got it from reading your book. my book, The Origins of Virtue. And I said, but it's not in that book. And he said, well, I thought it was, you know. So, and I think that's quite a nice example. And of course, you could play that either way. You could end up with me suing him or him suing me for, you know, breaching the patent or the copyright or something on it, which is not the way we played it. We were both delighted that between us somehow we'd come up with this idea. And we'd probably stolen it from Deirdre McCloskey or Jonah Goldberg or someone. You know, so.
Probably not from me.
But anyway, let me go back to the point about resistance to innovation, because I think you're absolutely right. Well, you're right and you're not right, because I think there's still a huge amount of resistance to innovation. In fact, I end the book a little bit pessimistically saying that it's getting worse, that we're experiencing an innovation famine at the moment compared with what we could be experiencing. And just to illustrate that, look at how unadvanced vaccine creation is. Turns out to be a process that takes 5 or 10 years, just like it did when two rather brilliant women who I talk about in the book developed the whooping cough vaccine in the 1930s. You know, who knew? I didn't know that we had made so little strides forward in accelerating the way we could create vaccines. I now know, and we've been playing Russian roulette with viruses, it turns out, all this time. So there's an awful, you know, the world's problem is that we haven't got enough innovation. And if you look at what's happening around the world, you see big corporations that are getting more and more sort of powerful in keeping incumbents out of their industries. You see more and more governments passing regulations to satisfy people who are a little bit frightened of change. You see more and more protest movements against innovation. We're living in an age which is pretty anti-innovation, I would argue. Now, is it as bad as the period before the Industrial Revolution? Probably not, because for all the protests that people mount today, they just can't quite seem to stop you and me buying a new version of the iPhone or whatever it might be. And by the way, sorry, I should, you know, with a nod to Peter Thiel here, say the digital world seems to be an exception to that. You know, we've been allowed to innovate in bits, not atoms, for the last 20 years. So what changed with the Industrial Revolution? Well, unlike Deirdre McCloskey, Joel Mokyr, many other people in this area, I don't tend to take the view that it's something cultural. I don't think we started respecting innovators, we started taking science seriously, any of those things. Sure, there might have been some of that, but I'm not convinced it was cause rather than effect. I'm a deeply materialist person on this point, and Deirdre and I have argued about this, and she's not impressed by my view. that it's about energy. It's that when you harness infinite, well, effectively infinite, and ever cheaper sources of energy, then you can innovate at a scale that can get one step ahead of the naysayers and the nihilists and the protesters. Because energy is so key to everything. You know, once you've got energy flowing into your system, you can do more trial and error, you can have more materials available. And what's happening in the Industrial Revolution is everything is changing. You know, metalwork is changing, and that enables people building steam engines to build better steam engines. And then because the steam engines are changing, you can pump the mines out easier, and that makes coal cheaper, and that makes energy cheaper. And so you get this terrific virtuous circle happening, and all, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, and the industries cross feed off each other. There's some very interesting borrowings going on in Britain in the 18th century, in Germany in the 19th century, etc., between different industries. So I feel it's a thermodynamic process, because after all, what is technology? Technology, like life, is a reversal of entropy. It's a creation of order. It's a creation of improbability. You know, we make structures like those books on the shelf behind you, which are highly improbable things. They've got, you know, the words are in the right order, mostly. you know, that couldn't come about by chance. The one thing we know about thermodynamics is to make order, to make improbable structures, you need to put energy into the system. And I think in the Industrial Revolution, we just found a way. It was called coal, and I come from the area where the coal was mined, so that might be my prejudice here. We found a way to supply more and more energy to the system, and that created unstoppable innovation in all sorts of fields.
Okay, I have a response to that, which I'll frame in the form of a question, but first I have a tangent. I remember when I was my father was a sort of classic Jewish intellectual in exile, and one of his favorite pastimes was to say strange things to me on the long walks. And I remember...
I think my son may well say that too.
I have a vivid memory of him explaining how the Black Hand in the Balkans was the first modern terrorist organization while pushing me on a swing when I was about 6 years old. But I once asked him on a Sunday walk to go get lox and bagels about whether God existed. And he said, well, think of it this way. A perfectly beautiful, perfectly running stopwatch is far more likely to be found on Mars than a single-celled creature, because a stopwatch is far less complicated than a single-celled creature, never mind a human being. And and so therefore this idea that this just all happened by happenstance seems unlikely. Now, I know there are responses to all of that, but when you talk about these things that defy entropy and all the rest, it does get my mind going back to all that. Okay, but back to the question. Okay,
can I slot in a very, very quick tangential point on that?
Sure.
Which is my friend Rory Sutherland, who's an advertising executive but a big thinker and thinks evolutionarily, made the point the other day. He said, you know, isn't it interesting? The entire world scientific elite are trying to work out how to solve the problem of creating immunity to a virus. When you catch that virus, in most cases, unless you die, within a week, your immune system has solved the same problem.
That's an interesting point. We're going to come to the virus in a little bit. But so on your point about innovation, I hear what you're saying, and I'm a big believer in this is a particular problem, which I've talked about a bunch on this podcast, for conservative intellectuals in particular, who are very, very interested in arguing about ideas. Mm-hmm. And the problem is they hold ideas constant over time while failing to take into account. Actually, you'll like this. This is what Whitaker Chambers called the Beaconsfield position after Benjamin Disraeli. And it was this idea that you have to take account for changes in the means of production to understand what is actually going on in a society. And the argument I always make is that, look, you know, the automobile did more to upset settled, stable communities in America than any weird idea that escaped a German lab and made it through France into America. But people like to argue with Nietzsche, and it's very difficult to argue with a Buick, you know, and so they don't address it. And at the same time, I'm against a lot of either ors in this discussion. I'm a both and guy. Mm-hmm. And so isn't the possible reconciliation between your position and Deirdre's position that the dynamic that you're talking about is real, and maybe it is the prime mover, maybe it's the chicken, not the egg, but at the same time, the cultural response to it is what makes all of these things possible, right? I mean, you start seeing the benefits from coal, and there were attempts to, you know, clamp down on that kind of thing. You know, there were Luddites and whatnot, but something in the culture, whether it was the Protestant Reformation or the sort of the Max Weber kind of take on these things, but there was something in the culture that adapted to this and turned a bug into a feature that allowed it to spread rapidly.
Absolutely right, and I would completely accept that, and the failed industrial revolutions of previous eras are really interesting in this respect, particularly mm-hmm. the Chinese one. I mean, if you look at the Song Dynasty, you get an extraordinary flowering of technology, but also of culture going on. And it looks like it's reached escape velocity, as it were. And then basically along come the Mongols and trash the place. But actually, they're not too bad because Kublai Khan gets the point and lets it continue. But then the Ming Dynasty starts, and the Ming Dynasty really does shut everything down. It tells every merchant that he's got to stay within 13 miles of his birthplace, you know, that kind of thing. ridiculous top-down bureaucratic mandarinate. Yes, you can certainly kill it with the wrong regime. And Britain was lucky. It was an island. So, Europe was lucky generally because it's got peninsulas and mountain ranges and islands that make it very hard to unify, whereas China's much easier to unify. That's an argument David Hume made a long time ago, and I think there's a lot of truth to it. And empires are really bad at innovation, actually. And also Britain had, had what you might call a hostile takeover by the Dutch a century before the Glorious Revolution, which had given us things like stock market.
Best case of regime change in world history, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, exactly. And for whatever reason, we also had a free trade area within the country, so people could move around. And for whatever reason, there was just enough freedom of thought. There wasn't that much freedom of thought. I mean, look what happened when somebody accused Adam Smith of preaching atheism at the University of Glasgow. And one of his colleagues was transported to Australia for heresy or something, so it wasn't all, you couldn't say what you thought in 18th century Britain as much as we think, but nonetheless there was just enough freedom of thought and freedom of stuff. And you can see, and obviously America catches the best of it. Jefferson and co bring all those ideas, well, they don't bring, they develop, they improve all those ideas. And again, America, the federal structure gives it a fragmented nature that keeps the flame alive, that doesn't let an imperial structure develop that would shut it down. So I think, yes, the politics. But just back to technological determinism very briefly, I'd be interested to know what you think about this. I take the view that the method by which we disseminate ideas, the actual nuts and bolts technology we use, influences how the political discourse happens. So the printing press is terribly important in explaining the Reformation. Likewise, radio is quite important in explaining the rise of the dictators. It's the perfect tool for demagogues. And likewise, social media is quite important in explaining the filter bubbles, echo chambers, and rise of populism today. We invent these technologies thinking that they're neutral, and they aren't. They have an impact on the way the world works. And in the book, I say, I was utopian. I thought once we had social media, we would all see each other's point of view, and it would all be kumbaya. Well,
as they say in the South, bless your heart. I'm with you on that. You know, Marshall McLuhan turned out to be right that the medium is the message in a lot in a big way. And I think what was the book, Entertaining Ourselves to Death, had a lot going for it as well. My basic take on all that is that the problem with social media, particularly Twitter and Facebook, is that we are hardwired, maybe not hardwired, but we are wired to want to live in small groups, right? I mean, you know this stuff much better than I do, and your book is one of the things that explained this to me. But, you know, there's the whole Dunbar's number. You know, we're only sort of built to understand a pretty small group of people. And the problem with Twitter and Facebook and these things is they make us feel like someone 2,000 miles away is our neighbor. And we get very angry when our neighbors are living wrong and behaving wrong in ways that we don't about, you know, strangers. But no one feels like a stranger anymore. They feel like, you know, and so you have these very bad culture war arguments because somebody in New York thinks somebody is misbehaving in California as if it affects their life. This is a point, a big fan of yours, Megan McArdle from the Washington Post, she asked me if I could get you to sign something, which is going to be difficult the way we're doing this by remote. But she said the problem with Twitter is it basically takes all the worst aspects of small town life and imposes them on the nation. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
I love her writing, by the way. Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot to be said for that.
I want to get back to one last question. I mean, we can talk about innovation all day, as far as I'm concerned. But I wanted to get back to the other question I wanted to ask you a while ago, and you actually kind of gave up the ghost when you said you're a technological determinist. Do you think there's a true teleology? I mean, because when I hear you talk about how no one person really innovated with this idea or invented this thing, and that this stuff was in the water, it makes it sound like some of these things were inevitable. And yet at the same time, you're talking about how we're living in an anti-innovation age where we are throwing wet blankets on these things. So which is it? Are they inevitable or can they be stopped?
I think you've put your finger on a real contradiction in my argument.
I'm sorry.
And I'm aware it's there, and I haven't resolved it. And I think my sort of pathetic answer is there's an element of inevitability, of determinism about what happens. Once you've started a ball rolling, it's going to go down the hill, not up. But the whole system is far too chaotic for it to be fully deterministic. Otherwise, we would just march slowly on from, ancient Greece to the nuclear weapons in a steady progress, which that clearly doesn't happen. First of all, it jumps around geographically. You know, there's Greece, and then there's Arabia, and then there's Italy, and at some point there's India, and there's China, and then there's Western Europe, and then there's North America, and then there's California, you know, etc. And now there's China. So why does the bushfire die out in some places and start up in others? And could it die out everywhere? And actually, in a previous book, I talked about the 12th century when the Arab world turned its back on learning after being very, very open to new ideas and and culture and technology. And it started burning books and becoming much more fundamentalist Islamic. And so did a lot of Western Europe too. So in France, the so-called medieval enlightenment got shut down by these various sort of mullahs of the time, as it were. China was having exactly the same phenomenon, that the Ming emperors were beginning to crack down. Well, it's a little bit later, but still, you know, so the thought experiment is, what if all those repressions succeed? What if we literally shut off learning and knowledge and technology and innovation completely and just freeze everything? And actually, this thought experiment is beautifully explored in a really spooky new novel by Robert Harris called The Second Sleep, which, I mean, I've already slightly given away the plot, but it's set in the future, and it feels like it's set in the medieval past. Now, in that case, I reckon the Italian city-states are crucial to keeping the embers glowing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Florence and Genoa and Venice and Milan and Lucca, which really sort of stop us sinking completely into ignorance and chaos. But I wonder what would happen today. You know, if as a result of pandemics or whatever, America, you know, literally gave up being this open-minded, creative place, and so did Europe, and the Chinese were doing everything and making everything and running everything, and then they became even more repressive and no new thoughts were allowed. Who would carry the flame? I'm pretty sure India would, actually. I think India is a great bet in the long run. A culture based on a form of spontaneous order or spontaneous disorder, if it's traffic in Delhi. So I'm fairly sure we could keep things going, but it's surprisingly precarious, this process of innovation. It's surprisingly reliant on a relatively small population at any one time in the world to keep it going. And that implies that that's where the indeterminacy is coming from, to come back to your point. Mm-hmm. It's reliant on the peculiar circumstances of wherever is the innovation game is afoot.
Yeah, that was one of the big takeaways I had from Charles Murray's book Human Accomplishment.
Yes.
You know, where he just basically, the phrase he uses is milieus, right? They're just these weird things that open up where you have some sort of unplanned critical mass of geniuses who ping off of each other in ways that make them better than they otherwise could be, you know? And so Vienna, you know, in terms of music at a certain, you know, for a 20-year period, just is this explosion of stuff, because it's sort of like you and the author you're talking about, you both, he thought he got the idea from you, right? I mean, it's like you can hear that in music. I'm not a big student of music, but you hear one thing, oh my gosh, I never thought you could do it that way. And it opens up this set of synapses in your brain that make you go in another way. Then somebody else hears it, and it's kind of this auto-catalytic process. And but I think going back to what you were saying earlier, you know, the advantages that Europe had and that America has, and that you can also talk about it in terms of the sort of Whiggish explanation of why this stuff started really in England and Holland, it's the decentralization that's key, right? It's you need, you know, it's sort of like you need all sorts of micro habitats that are fairly immune from the centralized power structure to go off on weird ways. And when you get standardization, that's what kills innovation more than anything else, it would seem to me.
Yeah, and this is where China's an interesting exception which proves the rule. Because when you say to people, well, China's very free at the moment, they say, what do you mean? Of course it's not free. The Communist Party is in charge. And, you know, they shoot you if you do the wrong thing. Well, maybe, they arrest you if you do the wrong thing. And yes, that's true at quite a high level. But below that, and you can find examples of Chinese businessmen talking about this. You know, the great thing about this country is that as long as I don't annoy the Communist Party, I can do what the hell I like. I can build a building. Right. I don't need to get, you know, the local planners to agree that to thing. I don't have to do a wildlife survey before I put up my factory. I don't have to put up with Greenpeace coming along and protesting or whatever it might be, or local rules and regs. I don't have to bother about intellectual property, by the way. I can steal that. So in that sense, it really is free, and that's why it works. And the big theme of my book, and I only realized this towards the end of writing it, actually, and that's why I put the subtitle in, Why It Flourishes in Freedom, is that innovation is crucially dependent on the freedom to make mistakes, the freedom to do trial and error, the freedom to go off at a tangent, because serendipity is very important here, because it's unplanned innovation, and there's a huge myth out there that you can plan it, direct it, you can tell people what to invent and what not to invent. It doesn't work that way. You just let them out into the playground and see what they come back with. Because of that, it really is crucial to have a decentralized system and to have a non-censorious system in terms of what people are allowed to do. And communist regimes like China can just about get away with that because they confine their censoriousness to one level, and that's politics, if you like.
So I mean, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, being able to make mistakes and work around censoriousness. It just highlights how important a product like ExpressVPN is. So we all know that ExpressVPN protects your privacy and security online, right? You know that? If you don't, you should. But here's something that you might not know that's actually pretty handy, particularly given the long lockdown. You can also use ExpressVPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Now that so many of us are stuck at home, it's only a matter of time until you run out of stuff to watch on Netflix. So the exciting news is, like, say you're like looking for something new and you can't find anything on American Netflix, well, Doctor Who is on UK Netflix. There are all sorts of things, you know, that you cannot get. I've discovered this because my daughter, when she was in Spain, she watched almost an entirely different Netflix than the one we have here. It's basically an undiscovered country for you to explore. It's so simple to do. Just fire up the ExpressVPN app, change your location to the UK, refresh Netflix, and bada boom, there you go. See, this is because ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through. Love anime? Use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away to a really weird, weird place. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service, Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason you should use ExpressVPN to watch shows is that it's ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD, no problem. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all of your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more, so you can watch what you want on a personal device or on the big screen, wherever you are. So, if you visit my special link right now at expressvpn.com/remnant, not dingo, for reasons that will remain historically a mystery, if you visit my special link right now at expressvpn.com/remnant, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show. Watch what you want and protect yourself with ExpressVPN at expressvpn.com/remnant. We thank ExpressVPN for sponsoring today's episode of The Remnant. So, when you're talking about planning innovation, I have a very close friend who was a Hollywood, this guy Rob Long, who was a big Hollywood TV producer and scriptwriter, and he always tells the story about how it may be apocryphal, but he uses it in speeches as sort of a joke. And he says, you know, there was a guy who, when the, I think the Japanese took over one of the big movie studios, he gives this, the head of the studio is briefing his new bosses. And he says, so next year, as typical with almost any given year, our studio will probably produce, 10 movies. Five will be bombs, three will do okay, and two will be really big hits. And at the end of the talk, one of the Japanese in the audience asks a question. He says, well, if you know that, why don't you just make the two hits? On the, you know, there's a lot of that sort of thing.
That's lovely.
So let's in the time we got left, let's switch gears a little bit. You've been writing a bunch of stuff for the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere and on Twitter about COVID, and I've been trying to like minimize pandemic talk on here, but just because I think people are being saturated with it, but. You're sort of an exception to the rule, and I have to get my dear friend Ron Bailey, who you know, on here soon, and he's going to cover all of this as well. You, in the piece I think you most recently did for the Journal, you seemed pretty confident that this was a naturally occurring thing and not from a lab, why don't you just sort of talk through what you think the actual origins of this. Have you changed your mind with these reports that maybe it did come from a lab? That doesn't mean it's naturally recurring. This is one of the great failings of the media, all this, is the media constantly thinks that it came from a lab means created by a lab rather than accidentally released from a lab. But anyway, why don't you just sort of give us your take about all of that?
Yeah. Well, I did a deep dive into the bat literature to understand this connection between the virus and the horseshoe bats of China. And I was particularly impressed by a very recently published paper that had just come out showing the connection between the particular bat sample where they first identified the virus in bats and the human version of the disease. And this was a bat sample they'd collected in 2013 for the Institute of Virology in Wuhan. And it's very similar to the virus we're catching today, but not quite similar enough for that sample to have leaked and be the source of it. It looks like it's about 40 years divergence in normal rates of genetic evolution. Okay. So, that whatever virus we have got, we caught from a bat that last was in connection with that bat 40 years ago. And that sort of makes sense because the cave they got this bat from was 1,000 miles from Wuhan. It was in Yunnan province. Okay. But as far as we know, that's the only sample of SARS-CoV-2, the virus we're talking about, from a bat. And therefore, it looks more likely that it was picked up from a local bat, a bat in Hubei province rather than Yunnan province. But when you say, well, that points the finger at the wet food market, the wet market, the wildlife market, and the fact that the pangolins were catching it too, also points a finger there. The market probably played a role, if only in amplifying the virus. But you then say, well, were bats for sale in that market? We don't know for sure. Bats are for sale in various markets in China, but they tend not to be horseshoe bats. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's usually fruit bats, and if it's not fruit bats, it's not necessarily horseshoe bats. They don't feature on the list of bats that I found, which were regularly being served in restaurants throughout southern China. So maybe the bats were hanging around the market and, you know, their droppings got eaten by some of these stressed animals in the market, and that's how it got amplified and we caught it. And that's still probably my default hypothesis. Okay. But I didn't put this in the article because it's still too uncertain yet. There is another plausible story that does involve a lab leak, not a bioweapon, but a lab leak, because there's another lab. It's called the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Hubei Province, and it's in Wuhan. It's very close to the seafood market, whereas the Institute of Virology is not. It's a lower security level lab. It's BSL level 2, not 4. And it had a researcher there called Tian Junhua, who was sampling bats in Hubei province for viruses. He was very open about this. He's published a number of papers about it. And he was one
of... there's nothing wrong with that. I mean...
Not that there's anything wrong with that!
There's nothing wrong with that. And he's taking precaution. We've got film of him, the Chinese... as a sort of promotional film was made of his work, because he's a sort of bit of a adventurer, as well as a, you know, he goes into these caves and he wears hazmat suits and it's all quite photogenic. And he says twice in, he had to self-isolate for a couple of days because he got contaminated by a bat, scratched or urinated on or something on his bare skin. So he voluntarily self-isolated. This is this film was made 3 years ago. So we're talking about, you know, sometime in the last few years. Now, he's working on horseshoe bats, among others. It's one of his papers talks about sampling 155 horseshoe bats from Hubei province. So these are much closer genetically and geographically to where we need to look. So it's not impossible that he brought bats to the lab for sampling, and that something about their juices got into the system somehow by accident, and then got amplified by the seafood market. That feels to me like a plausible hypothesis. And in order to investigate it, it would be very nice if the Chinese authorities would say, here is Tian Junhua. He's going to explain to you exactly everything he's done in the last few years and exactly how his lab protocols were. And you can ask him any questions you want. And we're going to do everything we can to test for samples all around that lab and the market and everywhere else. And we're going to publish this openly on the web. That would be the right thing for a responsible government to do. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're not seeing any signs of that.
Yeah. And I had a colleague of mine from AI, Lyman Stone, on here a few weeks ago. He's based out of Hong Kong. He's an economist, a sort of a real data guy. And his point, which he convinced me on before it became conventional wisdom, is that the most important thing in a pandemic isn't lockdown orders and quarantines, it is disseminating accurate information widely and clearly. And it sort of ties in in many ways with your point, right? So the point of your book, which is that if you get the information out there that there's a serious threat out there, people will, I mean, innovation is probably too grandiose a word, but people will respond with things like social distancing and staying home and being careful out of their own self-interest, rather than because some central authority told them to. And so his argument for why China deserves so much of the blame here isn't that it's an escaped bioweapon or any of these kinds of things. It is that they stood in the way of clear, accurate dissemination of knowledge when it could have mattered a great deal. And this is a debate that we have now in the States, which I wanted to ask you about. You're free to respond to any of that too. But in the States, there is, by my lights, the best way to characterize the debate, to borrow a term from social science, is incredibly bat stupid.
bat relevant.
Yes, I know. It's but the whole, there's this one side that has become very populist very quickly, or has had their populism intensified very quickly, that makes it sound like all it takes is for the state to lift these stay-at-home orders, and we can, quote-unquote, turn the economy back on. And it feeds into all sorts of crazy conspiracy theory stuff, depending on how far out on the spectrum you want to go. There is this tendency in the craziness of American politics these days to assume that any inconvenience, hardship, or even just simple disagreement must be, there must be evil motives on the other side of the argument, that if somehow our governor is shutting down the economy in Michigan or whatever, it must be because they are secret leftists who want to destroy capitalism, and it can't be that you're just trying to save lives and maybe doing too much. Are you seeing that kind of politics much in the UK with all of this? How is it just playing out on the ground over there?
In many ways, very similar. We're having a huge sort of blame game already about whether we were too slow to lock down in the first place and whether we are too slow to unlock now. Mm-hmm. The same people are sometimes making the same argument, actually, and not necessarily inconsistently.
We have that with Trump, where he is both in favor of the lockdown and against it.
I mean,
exactly. It's very confusing. But anyway, I'm sorry, go on.
And we have the slightly confusing complication that the prime minister is out of action.
Right.
And he was very, very ill. And we keep expecting him to reappear. He's done one video message and that's it. And he's not like Trump. He's a very different man from Trump in many ways. He's a very sort of gentle, friendly person, which not quite the right word to use for Donald Trump. But he is similarly iconic, mm-hmm. if you like. And so that matters. The thing that has spooked me is the degree to which the public seems to be almost enjoying the lockdown. Now that's the wrong thing to say, because a lot of people are not enjoying it. But there's an element of snitching on your neighbors. He went for two walks. Mm-hmm. And the police, in some cases, have been ridiculous in this country, going up to people sunbathing in a park all on their own and saying, go home, you should either be exercising or you should be at home. And actually, sunlight is a great disinfectant for viruses. We know that. And we're having great weather over here at the moment, ironically. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day who was out riding a horse along a road. And along came a cyclist and shouted at him, you shouldn't be riding your horse. What? You're riding your bicycle. You know, what's going on there? Hang on, that person might be enjoying themselves. Mm-hmm. That's what's going on, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that, you know, there's a nasty streak of fascism's the wrong word, but authority enjoyment.
Yeah,
that we're all a bit spooked by at the moment. On the
puritanical spirit finds this a happy medium here, right?
Yeah. I shouldn't have said people are enjoying the lockdown. That's not what I meant. But if you see what I mean, because it is brutal for a lot of people. But at the same time, we're also, of course, paying the wages of people who can't get to work, and so that is sort of enabling people to say, "Well, I'm in no hurry to unlock." And that could be disastrous. I mean, we are seeing so many businesses that the way I think of it is we're throttling the economy. We've got our hands on the windpipe of the economy. Now, if I were to throttle you for 30 seconds, you'd be fine when I took my hands away, I hope. Whereas if I did it for 3 minutes, it wouldn't be the same. So I think the length of these lockdowns is incredibly important. I think, but businesses can bounce back now, but another couple of weeks, and I'm not sure they could.
Yeah.
And that, I feel, is the sort of crucial debate at the moment. And also, we're slightly forgetting what the lockdown was for. The point, we were told the lockdown was in order to not overwhelm the health system, to flatten the curve, as it were. But the health system is now gearing up big time. We've built these temporary hospitals. We've got far more ventilators. Although it turns out ventilators aren't much help for people who are dying of this. But so if it was to give us time to to increase the capacity of the health system, we've done that. And so we should now then gradually unlock. And we should unlock the we ought to be able to work out which of the lockdown things matter most. I mean, it looks like locking down schools doesn't help that much. But preventing football matches or boxing matches with 40,000 people watching is quite important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And should continue for probably a year or so, unless we get a vaccine. So that's where we need to be having this conversation. And yes, it's at times getting as nasty over here as it is over there, although perhaps without quite the party political viciousness, partly because we just had an election. So we kind of got that out of our system in December. We resolved Brexit, which was our big polarization at the end of January. And although there's a lot of people very bitter about the way it was resolved, and that does map onto which side of this debate you're on to some degree, it perhaps doesn't map quite as neatly. You're in an election year. You're coming up to Donald Trump's re-election campaign, etc. And so I think it was inevitable that it would get tangled up in politics to the degree it has. But you would know more than I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's less. I mean, politics obviously is a big part of it, but it's stranger than that.
Yeah,
I agree with that. And I was going to ask you how it maps with Brexit because I was sort of interested in that. But we're already seeing the red state blue state divide express itself in which governors are for opening things up and which ones aren't. But the weirdest part about it is that. It really is like so much of our politics now has less to do with Republican versus Democrat and pro-Trump versus anti-Trump. And the people who are bought into the cult of Trump, as it were, also inconveniently for Trump are the people who are most against the lockdown. Yeah. And so you get this very strange, it's sort of like if only the czar knew, you know, kind of thing where... they want to simultaneously say that Trump is handling this fantastically, but that Anthony Fauci needs to be fired and that he's to blame for all of this for misleading the president. And they can't quite reconcile the fact that Anthony Fauci or Dr. Birx or whoever, that these advisors actually have no power.
Right.
And anything that the federal government is doing is at the behest of the president of the United States. But he has to be held blameless. And so it creates this really poisonous impulses towards scapegoatism and conspiracy theory. And they don't make rational sense. They just make intuitive sense given where we are in our politics, is the only way to sort of explain it.
Yeah. Well, I think our equivalent of that difficult argument is the question of the National Health Service versus the politicians, because we have a National Health Service which is revered, even though it's a pretty inefficient health system compared with others around the world, but not allowed to say that. And we have to go out every Thursday night, it's tonight, at 8 o'clock and clap on the street. And if you don't, and I know somebody who doesn't, you get shouted at. And that's a bit weird. And then at the same time, we've got it. The Public Health England, which is the body that's supposed to have been preparing for pandemics and things like that, and is a government body and is responsible for the diagnostic testing and the protective equipment and all that, has done a really, really terrible job of being over-centralized, slow, bureaucratic, et cetera, et cetera. And everyone knows that and agrees with that. But they don't blame Public Health England. They blame the politicians for not telling Public Health England to do it. And the politicians are at fault here because they said, it's our NHS and I am going to be responsible for it in an election campaign only 3 months ago. The weird thing is the politicians are getting the responsibility without having the power to enact something because they've put the bureaucracy at arm's length in administrative terms, but not at political in political that's terms. Interesting.
Okay, so unfortunately, Matt has to go. I'm not making this up. There are, ever since you invited Ron Bailey, who's one of my oldest friends, to come visit you once, I have said of living people within reason, that I would love to have a drink or 12 with, that you are on my list. And so this has been great. I wish we could have done it in person. I wish we could have done it over a pint or a bottle of scotch.
We will. But, we will. When this is all over, we will have drinks, meals. You'll come and visit. All of that. I would really.
That would be fantastic. So thank you so much for coming on, and happy to have you on again. And if you ever just have this the urge to come on, just shoot me an email and we'll set it up.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jonah. It's been really enjoyable. And can I just say one thing? Do you know what the first person to send me your book, Liberal Fascism, was? Was my, he's not necessarily an ideological bedfellow, James Watson, the DNA pioneer.
Really?
Yeah. He said, this is a very important book. You should read it.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, it's a little shocking. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, he comes out with some pretty weird pronouncements, as you know,
yeah.
Has done in his old age, but in his heyday, he was a great brain.
Well, there are a handful of people who I collect, because, you know, it's still a fairly reviled and vilified book here in the States. And if I had to write it over a different way today, I probably would, though not the stuff that is most reviled. But Tom Wolfe was a huge fan of it. And
wow, that's great.
And so was David Mamet. And so I'm collecting these kinds of stories. So thank you very much. Anyway, okay. Matt, thank you so much for coming on, and we will see you again.
Thank you again.
Okay, so Matt had to go. It kind of bums me out because I could talk to him for a very long time. As I was saying, we have mutual friends, and I knew he was going to be fun to talk to, but that's the first time I ever talked to him. And I think people know by now that I don't normally really gush over people. There are lots of people I've had on here who I respect a great deal. But as I believe the youth say, I'm a real Matt Ridley stan. And I feel like I should take a shower just having said that. But I really look forward to having him back on and hopefully someday getting together with him. And I hope people get a chance to actually listen to the first podcast of the week with Vin Cannato, because I think there's something useful. First of all, I love talking to Vin, and I thought it was a really interesting conversation, but also I just think there's something really, really useful in hearing that academia is not exactly the caricature that a lot of people think it is. There are, you know, I mean, there are conservatives out there. Vin would be the first one to admit that they're not exactly a majority, but it's a more complicated world actually on the campus than the caricatures we often get from a lot of right-wing media. And I thought it was a really interesting conversation, and I want to do more stuff with Vin, so people should check it out. And I know one of the weird counterintuitive things of the lockdown is people are actually listening to podcasts less. I think in part because podcast listenership is so sort of commute dependent and gym dependent and that kind of thing. And when you're home with your whole family, it's harder to do, and your normal schedule's messed up, and you're watching a lot more TV and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, we've had a really great backlog of podcasts that we've done. Some of the, I think, you know, I personally like doing podcasts in person with people so you can read the reactions. But I think some of the most interesting podcasts that we've ever had on The Remnant have been during the lockdown. So if you're not, you know, as great as ExpressVPN is, and by all means, stream as much video as you want. But, you know, a lot of the podcasts we've done are pretty long lasting and have a long shelf life. And so you should check them out. But if you need to stream, if you need to watch something, then I've got some exciting news for you. The last episode, the last live happy hour GLOP podcast, which was such a screaming success that we are doing another one. As I've said before, it was the first podcast I've done that actually left me with a hangover. And I'm going to be a little more careful this time, I think, but maybe not. Who knows? Since my family is around, I got to be a little more circumspect. But so John Podoritz, Rob Long, and I are doing a live Zoom GLOP Culture podcast this Sunday, April 26, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can sign up. You can sign up if you're a Dispatch member, only people who are Dispatch members or subscribers to Commentary or members of Ricochet can get in. But seating, quote unquote, is limited. The Zoom software we're using, I think, maxes out at 1,000, and we hit that last time. But so if you want to sign up, you should do so. You can go to thedispatch.com/dingo. That's thedispatch.com/dingo. And there's still time to become a paying member of the Dispatch community if you want and be able to check this thing out. All you got to do is go to thedispatch.com/dingo. And frankly, even if you don't want to watch the Glop thing, there will be a video link later if you can't watch it live, by the way. But even if you don't want to watch the Glop thing, if you could come, you know, if you can swing being a member, it would mean the world to us. We are persevering through this whole thing. We are not laying off anybody. We are not looking for charity. We think we're providing something really important, and what we're doing is really important. And we think the community that we're building is great. And, you know, the comments, some of them go a little off the rails, but for the most part, it's the first comments I regularly read in years. And it's because people sort of get that they need to be civil and thoughtful, even if they disagree. And we appreciate that. And there are going to be a lot more members only. And I don't mean the jacket events and opportunities going forward. And it'd be great if remnant listeners could be part of all of that. So with that, I didn't get Matt because he had to go and I didn't want to waste time explaining it to him. So I didn't get him to say, no, you won't. This is a podcast. So maybe we'll go back to our greatest hits and have a replay of the Latin one because I thought that was pretty awesome. So I'll see you next time.
Non me videris podcastum est.
Anything crazy stupid in that?